Mr. Cartorial 6, now you just fired the Alamein bombard, not the South, not Cesar's had, and the time early November, about 5th, 6th, they'd gone out of range, everyone, as the advance went on. What happened then? You moved forward, I presume?
Once the advance started, you keep moving up. Move forward to the vehicles, not the numbers going up, all the men, everything, get all your equipment up. Loaded onto the wagon. Of course, there was quite a lot of fuel shells left there, and they just went forward and just kept following up, and of course, the same shit you were doing. Once you met a target or a crew at the time, drop into action again.
Well, could you explain? So, tell me what the procedure was then for dropping the Matador and the 5.5 into action. Say you got an urgent call, how would you get the order?
Well, the order would come down to the by phone from the EOP, you see, the commander, one of the two commanders, you see, and he would go, he'd send it over to the tannoy, because sometimes the gun was very well pierced apart, and he couldn't shout because he wouldn't hear. And each gun more or less had a tannoy, and it came over the tannoy, you see.
So you'd be driving along?
Yes. You knew what to go, there would be a man at the front, you had a captain at the front, you see, the good captain, telling you exactly where you were going, you see, into action, you see.
How would he tell you?
Well, not going to the tannoy, or you just stop and see, right, action season, so to say. And you had your own business, because you knew A, B, C, D, where you were going to go for a second gun, and you just got into business with. Go into the Matador, and you see how it happens, you just jump out and you should point the men, which way you want the barrel pointing. Look round in the circle, whatever I have to do, get the gun into his knee, and into that position as I could, to see him help the men, a lot of hard work, go in with the gun, and as the gun is preparing to go for the action, walking the trails and everything, lifting the spears onto the gun, getting them all prepared for action, the driving, which was myself, and a couple of the guns would be on the start of the window to be able to get some of the shells off, which were already fused, the chargers, the detonators, and the pixel cells, and the equipment that we'd all need, such as hand spikes, ramrods, and everything. All that equipment would be picked up the same left of the gun, and we would move back, and we'd still be 100 yards, you see, just out of fire distance, until the end of the action. And then they finished.
And how long would all that take if you were doing it, if you were just in a hurry?
10 minutes at the most, because,
And how long before the first round was in the air?
Well, it wouldn't be long once you got the gun, once you got the last one, you see, because each gun had to get the last and shout, the number one had to shout back to the command and say, go and ready, sir. And then you just wait for the orders for you to get your position away. You have to find all the degrees and the minutes and the range. You have to wait for that coming through to you before you go into action.
How would Harper have got his zero line? I mean, you know, you just said he pointed the way he wanted the barrel. How would he have got that information?
We did it off compass.
Did you always set it on the same line?
Oh, no. It was only posted maybe 2 years ago. Traversing left or traversing right, but always put the gun forward. Once the barrel was forward, you see, if I remember, I think I had a 25 degree traverse on the far side because the gun was a split trail, you can traverse more.
But I mean, how did he know where to? I mean, was it always a set bearing?
No, it was orders coming down from the troop commander.
So when he was shouting, he'd shout that information.
That information that he was given. So many degrees this, so many degrees right, so many degrees left.
So what?
Then what set would be 18, all his orders coming through, so 18119, which was, if it was an 18119, that meant high explosive, 119, that was an explosive fuse on impact, 18117, that was the fuse there, it was slightly delayed. Then later on, we'll go 18210, which was a time setting fuse, which was a shrapnel. If you set the burst above ground with that, for Andy Pearson. So, with all these orders coming down from the OP down to the troop commander, and from the troop commander to the guns, you see.
Did you have any other types of shell, or was that it, those three?
The same shell, was just different fuses.
Sorry, yes.
Same shell, double driving band. And some of the other, as I say, but the first one were very rare, you know, so took them with a bit of respect and things, because it's unloading, you were loading one and off the vehicle, because the shells weren't in boxes there, they were just open. Just a piece of metal you picked up, and if you tackled this, you know, without any respect, the copper bands used to get damaged. And when you ram it home, instead of ramming in perfectly, you know, you start, you couldn't get the puncture. You could always hear this, it would go out, you could hear it whistling instead of going out the legs direct to the firing line. The charges, they were all in boxes. But the shells were just open. Because now you're very new, you're picking up, you're putting back in the matador, you're picking on the mat. Because the matador was pretty high in the amateur chap, we had to, I could lift them off the matador. A small man, he had to have the box of ammunition, the box of the charges to stand them.
Well, how heavy were the shells to lift? Were they?
100 pounds.
Was that alright?
Oh, yes, just in the middle of Well, of course, when they were loading up the gun, it was done by two men. You see, it was put onto a tree. And the tree had two hands either side. Two men picked it up, put it onto the beach, you see, and the rest of the crew had to ram up to ram it home, you see. But it didn't bother us to all the walls at the time. You could get time with it by the time you lifted 50 or 60 or that off. But it was only on a tree that was just came.
So, you've told us how they'd drop into action quickly, and then what was the reverse of that? What would you do?
Well, to come out of action, you'd do exactly the opposite, into the matador, back up to the gun pit, and the guns, by the time you get there, would be taking the sights up, putting everything away in the boxes, and start to close the trails, lift the spears off the trails, mount them onto the side of the would load the matador all the equipment before you limit the gun up nicely, you put all the remaining shells that you've got from then left, put all the ammunition and picks and shovels, all the equipment and the camouflage, put all that load all that back up the matador. And when everything was prepared on the matador, you know, everything was ready, just reverse the matador to the gun, limber up. Gun crew into the right back of the matador, and away.
So now you were moving forward, doing that sort of thing, dropping into action. What do you remember then of the move forward through Libya? Are there any incidents?
Well, the main thing I remember off the Battle of Alamein, actually, up the desert, no one knew what the rain was. But shortly after the Battle of Alamein, the heavens actually opened up with rain, and I still, in my belief anyway, that it was caused with the amount of shelling that was built into the atmosphere. And of course, when we got up there, what was doing was sliding about in that room, the sand couldn't take the rain. Of course, we also came across what were hundreds of dead bodies. We can just pour petrol or diesel oil over and set fire to it to protect ourselves from the disease. There's no time to stop giving them a body.
British and German, you do that too?
Not only mostly Germans, but there's a slow disease.
So you're moving forward, and what next?
Well, we're just moving forward, and as opposed to any troop movements, anything spotted, you would get the orders to come down the gate and you'll put it back to the troop for the drop into action. And the stage performance will be repeated again. And of course, now again, you stay with the one, instead of doing one spot, and then he's there 2 days, maybe there for 2 or 3 days. But you leave a little bit of Smith resistance. Because all the time, you know, all the time, when you were advancing in the legacy, you had to keep watching out for these scooters and that, you were coming down in the road to dive bombing that as well, you see.
So what's the next thing? There was various battles and things. Did you on the way? Do you remember the Christmas celebrations before Wadi Zemzem? Or?
Well, the Christmas, I remember. The Christmas was just before we got to the Tikhuk. I remember. First of all, just before Tahuna. Because when you grow up, when you think of Tahuna, well, I always remember Tahuna because it was just outside of Dublin, you know, it was the first green we ever saw. Date trees, olive groves, lemons, you know, that, you know. And of course, out there, we used to have a lot of little onions. And we were so delighted in seeing these things that we just made lungs out of ourselves, just picking everything off the trees, dates, anything that grew. Just picked it up, chopped it up, put it in the tins and boil it. You know, to make like a broth or a stew. A change from the corn. I always remember that. The tahuna, that was. That was just before we got the chicken. And when we got the chicken, we were supposed to stop.
Now, just outside Tripoli, there was a big raid where you got all your tyres punctured, apparently. Do you remember that? A really big raid by Stukas. Fair enough. So you move up to Tripoli. No problem.
Remember when we had a terrible job in changing the tyres. Because they were what they call split rim. They weren't very neat, and they just put the needle on, you pull the rim off and push the tyre out. The rim was in half. And of course, the neon shoe were on from that point there. I had two matadors with the winches trying to pull the two rims trying to pull the two rims apart from them because the tyres after being punctured, as long as the puncture wasn't severe, used to stay up, you know, for about 6 to 8 hours because there was a gate inside about 4 inches thick, which was a terrible job, you know, putting them in the sewer. They weren't flexible at all, you know. But in the time of the day, for a good purpose, they still hold the air, or what the pressure was left in for a number of hours to give you the chance to get it changed. But the rear set on there, I can't remember. But remember, that was doing what they were doing a particular day, was at the finish. Like crowbars, 14 pounders, you mentioned, they couldn't separate them. But the finish had two matadors pulling them, trying to pull them apart. Because if you notice a really heavy vehicle, the wheels just seem like nuts around. Well, that's what they are, they're the nuts of the split rim. You take those nuts off first, and the rim comes up in halves.
So you moved into Tripoli. Did you actually go into Tripoli?
Just on foot. Just the outside.
Now, do you remember Churchill visited you? What did you think of Churchill? And
he was a very good man. I think he was the right man. That was tight. I think he was definitely not only the right man, he was the only man who could have done the job.
Did you think that at the time?
At the time, yes. Well, I still think it. Were
you impressed by him? Did he say anything?
He didn't speak to me, no. But I think he spoke to one or two of them.
What about Montgomery? He was with him.
Well, he was a different kind of man altogether, Montgomery. I don't know. I never talked to Montgomery, actually.
Why not?
He looked a sly man, I think that's the correct way to express it. But when I went up the desert, a different place, the regiment used to come across to Sir Brian Hawkes, a person who I really liked. But I don't know, Montgomery seemed to distance himself from people, I don't know. and gave me that impression.
What? What?
I know Churchill came round and he was asking questions on the guns, and he knew pretty well, he was really pretty well educated up on the firefighter, because he seemed to know quite a bit about them.
Now, while you were getting a few inspections in this period, and one thing the book mentions is that the surplus vehicles and the battery were driven away into the scrub, you know. And there's this thing that it comes up time and time again in this history, that the South Nuts Hussars used to like to get any extra vehicles they could. Were you aware of that? Did you do that?
I had done that myself.
How would you go about it?
Be dishonest. Just go and pick it from somebody else. That's the only way to get equipment. In the fact, I forget what one it was. But later on, there's another guy who came up with us. The 64th. And we had a bit of trouble with ties that we were having. There was no way to get supplies. In fact, I don't have any members of the law. So I went out and she's where you've been. I said, oh, I've got 2 years. And we've been out there, and I've jacked up and got the knees up in the way. And that's the only way to do.
And the same with vehicles.
You see, with vehicles, if you had any surplus vehicles, and you knew you had any surplus vehicles, you know what they call over. What's the term? Over establishment, is it the store? You had to hide them on the road.
Now, I believe shortly after Tripoli, you had to go back to Cairo. Could you explain the background to that? Why was that?
Well, big professional section there, Howard Harper, he was the sergeant of the building. We had to go back to Cairo to Abbasin Barracks to get a new battle put on, a new piece.
Now, why had you needed that and nobody else?
Well, I was going to do most of the firing.
Why was that?
Well, any quick firing, you know, we would always seem to be picked.
Why?
Well, that was a good thing.
You were
to do any Harrison fire, you know, we always used to be picked on to do the first shoot, and then the rest to get the rest of the guns lined up with that on that particular degree and angle or
registering.
To register. And then the rest of the police shooting was really all down the gun, you see.
So you'd fired a lot more shots than the others? And the barrel had gone?
The right thing on the barrel was nothing left. The shells were starting to go inside.
Now, didn't anyone carry a spare barrel with you, or was it just too big?
Change a piece of equipment like that at the desert where you had sandstorms and dust storms, where you have inside the recuperators or in dealing with springs and oil, where everything has to be more or less lovely and clean. You just couldn't do that under the circumstances. Through the weather, dust and sandstorms.
So shortly after.
On top of that, there wasn't even the equipment. You see the LED, which was the back markers in the red, and the others were probably last in case anything being done. I mean, that's why it was called light ear detachment, you see. So they couldn't do anything. Kind of work with, you see.
So the only place you could get a new barrel was to go right back. So was that your job to drive back?
Yeah.
Did the whole crew go with you?
No, there was only a couple.
So you drove all the way from Tripoli to Cairo?
That's the way it actually was, Peter. That was life. Day in and day out. You know, there's nowhere to go that needs to just throw anybody. You know, can you fix it up with a cup of tea or something? That's what we did. went back to Cairo, and of course, when they, I think it was a week or so, got the gun on, limbered up, and just made me out of this room back up the desert. And by that time, well, I'd nearly 1,000 miles to go up. It's good because they, you know, they were advancing every. They've got them on the move, and they didn't want to stop. They wanted to keep them going. You see, of course, as I say, we didn't stop until we got the man up, the Medellin.
Now, what was the situation at the Medellin?
We're coming up from the desert, from the plateau, we came up to the Medellin, and then, of course, we came up to what they call the Mountains. And, of course, Ronald and the army, after the call, was dug in there. And, of course, we couldn't put our heads up, more or less, because we were on the site on this scrutiny all the time. And what I always remember about the particular thing about the Medellin, there was a hill there, a pretty high hill. It was the divisional OP, where they had all the, I'm not sure it was a brigadier or somebody, well, higher rank of it anyway. And, it was a both regiment, I recall, protecting us, because we had the heavies and firefighters. And I always remember the raid on there one day, and they came in and had a direct hit on the gun, of course, the whole lot, all the men all wiped out the whole lot, which sort of upset you a bit, like, but you just had to just say, you know, it's been an everyday occurrence to get on with the job, but that's one particular thing that I don't remember.
Now, the B troop came under fire from Nebelwerfers for the first time, they reckon there.
Right, could you notice?
I mean, obviously you know, but were you aware that this was a new weapon?
Well, we didn't know what they were.
What was it like under Nebelwerfer fire that first time?
Terrible, because you could put them into the. If you had a slip trench, you could pack and put them in the slip trench where you were in. Once you got the range. In fact, that was the same as the pump. We should all see that regularly, because you could put them in a tin hat. You know, it was pretty accurate. I think, I'm not sure it was. Was it 8 or 12 that was fired over there? Metalware, as we used to call them.
Call them what?
We used to call them, nicknamed them, Meppel Whirlers.
Meppel?
That's what we used to call them, Meppel Whirlers.
Why me?
Well, because you couldn't see that name. But they were pretty accurate and pretty deadly for a piece of equipment that we had there. But, because if I asked you what happened there, we had we brought a squad of Spitfires a few miles behind us to try and, because we found out he had two particular long-range guns, 210s, which were pretty substantial guns, and he had to just stand back and just pump it so that we couldn't touch them. They brought these Spitfires up to try and get up and load, but then they finished it, they tried to get us forward so that they got to these two ones. Of course, Matthew Lee didn't even have the range. Later on, of course, it was a welfare that I feel it. Remember that he was telling me.
So, what about Marath itself? Do you remember that at all? The Battle of Marath, as opposed to.
The Battle of Marath, that was about the last time we made, a push. And if I remember, I think it was only 23 tanks that was knocked out there at a particular time. And our guns, in fact, my memory shows me correctly, I think we fired about 2,300 yards range, which was open sights, which was a pretty, what's the word, it's a new thing, you know, with the medium gun, 2,000 yards, and because by the tanks advancing towards the attack, you wouldn't have much time to lift a gun up out of the back and get it mounted and be out with, you know, but. I think it was 2,300 yards over sight of fire. In fact, I'm sure we kept and knocked out the fuel in there, direct hits. I think that should be in that book. And then there was only the one road through Marath itself up the coast, which of course nobody could do. You couldn't get past it, you know, if you put your head out you were pretty well covered. Then it came, it was suggested to him that our troop would be and big troop would be and we picked, you know, to try and go around and outflank them.
Now that's with the Gurkhas.
That's when I went with the Gurkhas.
What What did you feel about that?
Well, at first we felt we were a little bit worried because we were worried about the girls themselves because we knew their ability and their capability and what they could do. Wonderful, wonderful men, wonderful soldiers. But we were worried about what we would have to do to help them. So we all started flower playbooks in with the wheels in case we didn't come back. But when it worked out, it was the best time we ever had in our lives because we had a fire show.
What do you remember of it then? You were doing a sort of left hook, weren't you?
Yes. Well, when we to get onto this left hook, I had to go so far up the mountains, and we came to this particular track, which was only a car track, and it went round and round, you know, he's winding round. When he looked over the top, he's talking about the 2,000 foot drop. Well, like the guns and the matadors were so long, so big. Going down this track was getting a bit worried, so I went up and I said, I explained to Harlap, I said, look, Harlap, you better stop the troop and tell the commander here, says, we better have to let these guns down here on a winch. Which we did. And each gun was individually winched down, let down on the winch of the matador. Because the corners were so acute. Because on top of that, the surface was all rubber. You just had to put your brakes on and skid. And the gun and everything, all of them, you go over the top. But luckily, we did a good job. We all got down safe and sound. It took a long time. We all got down safe and sound. But from what I gather, after that.
So. There's a bit in the book about you actually mentioned in the history here that you were using the Walker had no brakes on his Matador and Cutter used his as the brake.
That's right, yeah. I was letting them all down as it was on the winch. Well, actually, I practically took command of that operation because, as I say, through my experience of being in the quarry, all this kind of work. It all came back. And it was a good thing because it happened there. And it came. And then I said, look, going around the corners, you see, it was so acute. You could never get round with the vehicle or the gun. So I put limbs them all and let them all down on the wind. So every particular gun, each matador went down on his own, except Walker, and I let him down on my wind as well. Because actually, after the operation was finished, but from what I gather, the brigadier immediately wanted to know how many guns that were lost. It was so delicate an operation.
He thought he'd have lost some over the side.
But we were rather surprised and a bit of a shock when he was told there was nothing. We were all standing waiting and limbered up for fresh orders. And I think we got a bit of a shock.
So what happened then? You got through, yeah. And was there anything else to that?
I can't remember. I don't think there was any action after that. I can't remember going into action after that again because they say the dirt is being rather going quietly without any pre-notice, like, you know.
So you didn't fire a preparatory bombardment?
No, we didn't fire a preparatory bombardment. But I also think, it was the 2nd New Zealand Division we were trying to get round to. I think I'm not sure, is that right? Just wearing up on the rock, you know, in case it got worn and went to the dirt. But we're doing very well and there's absolutely nothing left. Good job there.
Now, you then went into, this is where there's a question of a Lance Sergeant McCall, I think. He was killed by a booby trap. What do you remember about that? And were you aware of the risk of booby traps as you passed through towns?
Oh, well, we were constantly warned by army orders and messages. If you did get into a trap, into a town, keep away from houses, keep away from doors, don't do this, don't open doors, don't do this, don't do it. Because the booby trap is actually really high ties. You catch it with you. Because McCall did. A nice man.
Were you there when it happened?
I wasn't there when it happened.
You say Itais, you mean Itais and Germans? Or
yeah, it's mostly the Italians. It's mostly the way, you see, the Italians, it was more or less the only way they hit back at you. You know, the dirty tricks, if you see, the booby trap. But actually, Sergeant McCall, being a sergeant in particular, you thought he would have had more sense in the first place in history. You were constantly warned, I'd say that.